down. "She's not trapped down there," Anna said. "She can get out through the cargo bay. There's a hole in the doors." "That's twice now someone has done that," Naomi replied, pulling herself up the ladder. "Anyway, she's wearing a salvage mech rig, and she's in the machine shop. Half the stuff in there is made to cut through ships. She's not trapped. We are." This took Anna by surprise. They'd gotten away. They'd locked a door behind them. That was supposed to end it. The monster isn't allowed to open doors. It was fuzzy, juvenile thinking. And Anna became less sure that all the drugs had actually passed through her system. "So, what do we do?" "Medical bay," Naomi said, pointing down a short corridor. "That way." That made sense. The frail-looking Belter woman was getting a gray tone to her dark skin that made Anna think of massive blood loss, and the bandage on her shoulder had already soaked through and was throwing off tiny crimson spheres. She took Naomi by the hand and pulled her down the corridor to the medical bay door. It was closed, and the panel next to it flashed the security lockdown message like the deck hatches had. Naomi started pressing it, and Anna waited for the door to slide open. Instead, another, heavier-looking door slid into place over the first, and the panel Naomi was working on went dark. "Pressure doors," Naomi said. "Harder to get through." "But we're on this side of them." "Yeah? Is there another way in?" Anna asked. "No. Let's go." "Wait," Anna said. "We need to get you in there. You're very badly hurt." Naomi turned to look at her, frowned as if she'd only really seen Anna for the first time. It was a speculative frown. Anna felt she was being sized up. "I have two injured men in there. My crew. They're helpless," Naomi finally said. "Now they're as safe as I can make them. So you and I are going to go up to the next deck, get a gun, and make sure she follows us. When she shows up, we're going to kill her." "I don't," Anna started. "Kill her. Can you do that?" "Kill? No, I can't," Anna said. It was the truth. Naomi stared at her for a second longer, then just shrugged with her good hand. "Okay then, come with me." They moved through the next hatch to the deck above. Most of the space was taken up by an airlock and storage lockers. Some of the lockers were large enough to hold vacuum suits and EVA packs. Others were smaller. Naomi opened one of the smaller lockers and pulled out a thick black handgun. "I've never shot anyone either," she said, pulling the slide back and loading a round. To Anna's eye, the bullet looked like a tiny rocket. "But those two men in the med bay are my family, and this is my home." "I understand," Anna said. "Good, because I can't have you..." Naomi started, then her eyes rolled up in her head, and her body went limp. The gun drifted away from her relaxed hand. "No, no, no," Anna repeated in a sudden wash of panic. She floated over to Naomi and held her wrist. There was still a pulse, but it was faint. She dug through the first aid pack, looking for something to help. One ampule said it was for keeping people from going into shock, so Anna jabbed Naomi with it. She didn't wake up. The air in the room began to smell different, hot. And with a melted plastic odor, her damaged taser had given off when it died. A spot of red appeared on the deck hatch, then shifted to yellow, then to white. The girl in the mech, coming for them. The hatch above them, the one that led forward on the ship, was closed and flashing the lockdown message. Naomi hadn't told her what the override code was. The airlock was on their level, but it was locked down too. The deck hatch began to open in lurching increments. Anna could hear Melba panting and cursing as she forced it, and Naomi's lockdown code hadn't kept the insane woman out. It had only locked them in. Anna pulled Naomi's limp body over to one of the large vacuum suit storage lockers and put her inside, climbing in after her. There was no lock on the door. Between the unconscious woman and the suit, there was hardly enough room for her to close it. She set both of her feet at the corner where the door of the locker met the deck and set the magnets up to full. She felt the suit lock onto the metal, clamping her legs into place and pulling her up close against the locker door. On the far side, metal shrieked. Something wet brushed against the back of Anna's neck. Naomi's hand, limp and bloody. Anna tried not to move, tried not to breathe loudly. The prayer she offered up was hardly more than a confusion of fear and hope. A locker door slammed open off to her left. Then another one, closer, and then another. Anna wondered where Naomi's gun had gotten to. It was in the locker somewhere, but there was no light, and she'd have to unlock the magnets on her boots to look for it. She hoped they hadn't left it outside with the crazy woman. Another locker opened. The door, centimeters from Anna's face, shifted, but didn't open. The vents and the cracks in the locker door flared the white of a cutting torch, then went dark. A mechanical voice said, "Backup power depleted." The curse from the other side was pure frustration. It was followed by a series of grunts and thumps. Melba taking the mech rig off. Anna felt a surge of hope. "Open it," Melba said. Her voice was low, rough, and bestial. "No, open it." I can hear that you're feeling upset," Anna said, horrified by the words even as she spoke them. "I think we should talk about this if you..." Melba's scream was unlike anything Anna had heard before. Deep and vicious and wild. If the id had a throat, it would have sounded like that. If the devil spoke. Something struck the metal door, and Anna flinched back. Then another blow. And another. The metal began to bow in, and droplets of blood clung to the vent slits. Her fists, Anna thought. She's doing this with her hands. The screaming was wild now, obscene where it wasn't wordless, and inhuman as a hurricane. The thick metal of the door bent in, the hinges starting to shudder and bend with each new assault. Anna closed her eyes. The top hinge gave way, shattering. And then, without warning, silence fell. Anna waited, sure she was being lulled into a trap. No sound came, except a small animal gurgle. She could smell the stomach-turning acid stench of fresh vomit. After what felt like hours, she turned off the magnets and pushed the warped and abused door open. Melba floated curled against the wall, her hands pressed to her belly, and her body shuddering. Chapter 29. Bull. The truth was, distance was always measured in time. It wasn't the sort of thing Bull usually thought about, but his enforced physical stillness was doing strange things with his awareness. Even in the middle of the constant press of events, the calls and coordination, the scolding from his doctor, he felt some part of his mind coming loose. And strange ideas kept floating in, like the way that distance got measured in time. Centuries before, a trip across the Atlantic Ocean would take months. There was a town near New Mexico named Wheelless, where the story was some ancient travelers of the Dust and Caliche had a wagon breakdown and decided that it was easier to put down roots than go on. Technologies had come, each building on the ones before, and months became weeks, and then hours. And outside the gravity well, where machines were freed from the tyranny of air resistance and gravity, the effect was even more profound. When the orbits were right, the journey from Luna to Mars could take as little as 12 days. The trek from Saturn to Ceres, a few months. And because they were out there with their primate brains evolved on the plains of prehistoric Africa, everyone had a sense of how far it was. Saturn to Ceres was a few months. Luna to Mars was a few days. Distance was time, and so they didn't get overwhelmed by it. The slow zone had changed that. Looking at a readout, the ships from Earth and Mars were clustered together like a handful of dried peas thrown in the same bowl. They were drifting now, coming together and spreading apart, taking their places in the captured ring around the Eerie station. Compared to the volume of ring-bordered sphere, they seemed huddled close. But the distance between them and the ring was time, and time meant death. From the farthest of the ships to the behemoth was 2 days' travel in a shuttle, assuming that the maximum speed didn't ratchet down again. The closest he could have jumped to. The human universe had contracted, and was contracting more. With every connection, every stark, frightened voice he heard in the long, frantic hours, Bull grew more convinced that his plan could work. The vastness and strangeness and unreasonable danger of the universe had traumatized everyone it hadn't killed. There was a hunger to go home, to huddle together, back in the village. The instinct was the opposite of war, and as long as he could see it cultivated, as long as the response to the tragedies of the lockdown were to get one another's backs and see that everyone who needed care got it, the grief and fear might not turn to more violence. The feed went to green, then blue, and then Monica Stewart was smiling professionally into the camera. She looked tired, sober, but human, a face people knew, one they could recognize and feel comfortable with. "Ladies and gentlemen," she said, "welcome to the first broadcast of Radio Free Slow Zone, coming to you from our temporary offices here on board the OPA battleship Behemoth. I am a citizen of Earth and a civilian, but it's my hope that this program can be of some use to all of us in this time of crisis. In addition to bringing whatever unclassified news and information we can, we will also be conducting interviews with the command crews of the ships, civilian leaders on the Thomas Prince, and live musical performances. It's an honor to welcome our first guest, the Reverend Father Hector Cortez." A graphic window opened, and the priest appeared. To Bull's eyes, the man looked pretty ragged. The two bright teeth seemed false, and the blazing white hair had a greasy look to it. "Father Cortez," Monica Stewart said, "you have been helping with the relief effort on the Thomas Prince." For a moment, the man seemed not to have heard her. A smile jerked into place. "I have," the old man said. "I have, and it's been... Monica, I'm humbled. I am... humbled." Bull turned off the feed. It was something. It was better than nothing. The Martian frigate Cavalier, now under the command of a second lieutenant named Skupski, was shutting down its reactors and transferring all its remaining crew and supplies to the Behemoth. The Thomas Prince had agreed to move its wounded, its medical team, and all the remaining civilians, poets, priests, and politicians, including the dead-eyed Hector Cortez. It was a beginning, but it wasn't all he could do. If they were to keep coming, if the Behemoth was to become the symbol of calm and stability and certainty that he needed it to be, there had to be more. The broadcast channel could give a voice and a face to the growing consolidation. He'd need to talk to Monica Stewart about it some more. Maybe there could be some sort of organized mourning of the dead. a council with representatives from all sides that could make an evacuation plan and start getting people back through the ring and home. Except that when the lockdown came, they'd lost all their long-distance ships to it, and the ring itself had retreated, because they had to move so slowly, and because distance was measured in time. His hand terminal chirped, and he came back to wakefulness with a start. Outside his room, a woman shouted, and a man's tense voice replied. Bull recognized the sound of the crash team rushing to try and revive some poor bastard from collapsing into death. He felt for the team of medics. He was doing the same kind of work, just on a different scale. He shifted his arms, scooped up the terminal, and accepted the connection. Serge appeared on the screen.
Bist? He asked.
I'm doing great, Bull said dryly. What's up?
Mars, they've got him, hauling the cabron back alive.
Instinctively, uselessly, Bull tried to sit up. He couldn't sit, and up was a polite abstraction.
Holden, he said.
Who else, right?
He's on a skiff, puttering slow for the MCRN Hammurabi. Should be there in a few hours.
No, Bull said. They've got to bring him here.
Serge raised his hand in a belter's nod, but his expression was skeptical.
Asi dalsi si, but I don't see them doing it.
Somewhere far away, down below Bull's chest, the compression sleeves hissed and chuffed and expanded, massaging the blood and lymph around his body now that movement wouldn't keep his fluids from pooling. He couldn't feel it. If they'd caught fire, he wouldn't feel it. Something deep and atavistic shifted in fear and disgust as his hindbrain rediscovered his injuries for the 1,000th time. Bull ground the heel of his palm against the bridge of his nose.
Okay, he said. I'll see what I can do. What does Sam say about the project?
She got the railguns off, and they're working on cutting back the extra torpedo tubes. But the captain found out, and he's throwing Grand Mal.
Well, that had to happen sometime, Bull said. Guess I'll take care of that, too. Anything else?
Unless tu lavi misianis, I think you got plenty. Take a breath. We'll take a turn, Sasa.
You don't have to do it all yourself.
I've got to do something, Bull said as the compression sleeves relaxed with a sigh.
I'll be in touch.
Tense, low voices drifted in with the burned moth stink of cauterized flesh. Bull let his gaze focus on the blue-white ceiling above the bed he was strapped to. Holden was back. They hadn't killed him. If there was one thing that had the potential to destroy the fragile cooperation he was building, it would be the fight over who got to hold James Holden's nuts to a Bunsen burner. Bull scratched his shoulder, more for the sensation than because it itched, and considered the consequences. Protocol was that they'd question him, hold him in detention, and start negotiating extradition with whoever on the Earth side was investigating the Sung Un. Bull's guess was that they'd beat him bloody and drop him outside. The man was in custody, but he was responsible for too many deaths to assume he'd be safe there. It was time to try hailing the Rocinante again. Maybe this time they'd answer. Since the catastrophe, they'd been silent. Their communications array might have been damaged. They might be staying silent as some sort of political tactic, or they might all be dying, or dead. He requested a connection again, and waited with no particular hope of being answered. Later, when they were outside the ring, people could wrestle for jurisdiction as much as they wanted. Right now, Bull needed them to work together. Maybe if he... Against all expectation, the connection to the Rocinante opened. A woman Bull didn't recognize appeared. Pale skin, unrestrained red hair haloing her face. The smudge on her cheek might have been grease or blood.
Yes, the woman said. Hello.
Who is this? Can you help us?
My name's Carlos Baca, Bull said, swallowing shock and confusion before they could get to his voice. I'm chief security officer on the behemoth. And yes, I can help you.
Oh, thank God, the woman said.
So how about you tell me who you are and what the situation is over there?
My name is Anna Volovidov, and I have a woman who tried to kill the crew of the Rocinante in, custody? I used all the sedatives in the emergency pack because I can't get into the actual medical bay. I taped her to a chair. Also, I think she may have blown up the Sung-un.
Bull folded his hands together.
Why don't you tell me about that? He said.
Captain Jacunda was an older woman, silver-haired with a take-no-shit military attitude that Bull respected, even though he didn't like it.
I still don't have orders to release the prisoner, Captain Jacunda said. I don't see that it's likely that I'll get them. So for the foreseeable future, no.
I have a shuttle already going to collect his crew and the woman he accused of being the real saboteur, Bull said. And last time I looked, I have 24 of your people slated to come over once we have the drums spun up.
Jacunda nodded once, confirming everything he'd said without being moved by any of it. Bull knotted his fingers together and squeezed until the knuckles were white, but he did it out of range of the communication deck's cameras.
It's going to be better for all of us if we can get everyone together, Bull said. Pool resources and plan the evacuation. If you don't have shuttles, I can arrange transportation for you and your crew. There's plenty of space here.
I agree that it would be better to be under a single command, Jacunda said. If you are offering to turn over the behemoth, I'm willing to accept control and responsibility.
Not where I was taking that, no, Bull said.
I didn't think so.
Mr. Baca, Ashford barked from the doorway. Bull held out a hand in a just-a-minute gesture.
This is something we're going to have to revisit, he said. I've got a lot of respect for you and your position, and I'm sure we can find a way to get this done right.
Her expression made it clear she didn't see anything wrong.
I'll be in touch, Bull said, and dropped the connection.
So much for the pleasant part of his day. Ashford pulled himself through the door, coming to rest against the wall nearest the foot of Bull's bed. He looked angry, but it was a different kind of angry. Bull was used to seeing Ashford cautious, even tentative. This man wasn't either. Everything about him spoke of barely restrained rage.
Grief makes people crazy, Bull thought.
Grief and guilt and embarrassment altogether maybe did worse. Maybe it broke people. Pa floated in behind him, her eyes cast down. Her face had the odd, waxy look that came from exhaustion. The doctor followed her, and then Serge and Makondo, looking any place but at him. The crowd filled the little room past its capacity.
Mr. Baca, Ashford said, biting at each syllable.
I understand you gave the order to disarm the ship. Is that true?
Disarm the ship? Bull said,
and looked at Dr. Sterling. Her gaze was straight on and unreadable.
I had Sam take the railguns off so she could spin up the drum.
And you did this without my permission.
Permission for what?
Blood darkened Ashford's face, and rage roughened his voice.
The railguns are a central component of this ship's defensive capabilities.
Not if they don't work, Bull said. I had her take apart the thrust gravity water reclamation system, too. Rebuild it at 90 degrees so it'll use the spin. You want me to run through all the stuff I'm having her repurpose because it doesn't work anymore, or are we just caring about the guns?
I also understand that you have authorized non-OPA personnel to have access to the communications channels of the ship. Earthers, Martians, all the people we came out here to keep in line.
Is that why we came out here? Bull said.
It wasn't a denial, and that seemed to be close enough to a confession for Ashford. Besides which, it wasn't like Bull had been hiding it. And enemy military personnel? You're bringing them aboard my ship as well? Pa had agreed to everything Ashford was listing off. But she stood behind the captain, not speaking up, expression unreadable. Bull wasn't sure what was going on between the captain and his XO, but if they were working out some internal power struggle, Bull knew which side he'd want to end up on. So he bit the bullet and didn't mention Pa's involvement.
Yes, I'm bringing in everyone I can get. Humanitarian outreach and consolidation of control. It's textbook. A second year would know to do it.
Pa winced at that.
Mr. Baca, you have exceeded your authority. You have ignored the chain of command. All orders given by you, all permissions granted by you, are hereby revoked. I am relieving you of duty and instructing that you be placed in a medical coma until such time as you can be evacuated.
Like fuck you are, Bull said. He hadn't intended to, but the words came out like a reflex. They seemed to float in the air between them, and Bull discovered that he'd meant them.
This isn't open for debate, Ashford said coldly.
Damn right it's not, Bull said. The reason you're in charge of this mission and not me is that Fred Johnson didn't think the crew would be comfortable with an Earther running a Belter ship. You got the job because you kissed all the right political asses. You know what? Good for you. Hope your career takes off like a fucking rocket. Pa's here for the same reason. She's got the right-sized head, though at least hers doesn't seem to be empty.
That's a racist insult, Ashford said, trying to interrupt. And I won't have...
I'm here because they needed someone who could get the job done, and they knew we were screwed.
And you know what? We're still screwed. But I'm going to get us out of here. And I'm going to keep Fred from being embarrassed by what we did here. And you are going to stay out of my way while I do it, you pinche motherfucker.
That's enough, Mr. Baca. I will...
You know it's true,
Bull said, shifting to face Pa. Her expression was closed, empty.
If he's in charge of this, he's going to get it wrong. You've seen it.
You know you will stop addressing the XO, Mr. Baca. What kind of decisions he makes. He'll send them back to their ships, even if it means people die, because you are relieved. You will be, he wasn't the one that invited them. It's going to, quiet, I do not give you permission, make all of this more dangerous, and if someone to speak to my staff, you will be, else pisses that thing off, we could all, quiet,
Ashford shouted, and he pushed forward, his mouth in a square gape of rage.
He hit the medical bed too hard, pressing into Bull, grabbing him by the shoulder and shaking him hard enough to snap his teeth shut.
I told you to shut up!
The restraints opened under Ashford's attack, the Velcro ripping. Pain lanced through Bull's neck like someone was pushing a screwdriver into his back. He tried to push the captain away, but there was nothing to grab hold of. His knuckles cracked against something hard. The table, the wall, something else. He couldn't say what. People around him were shouting. His balance felt profoundly wrong. The dead weight of his body flowing limp and useless in the empty air, but tugged at by the tubes and the catheters. When the world made sense again, he was at a 40-degree angle above the table, his head pointing down. Pa and Makondo were gripping Ashford's arms, the captain's hands bent into claws. Serge was bunched against the wall, ready to launch, but not sure what direction he should go. Dr. Sterling appeared at his side, gathering his legs and drawing him quickly and professionally back toward the bed. "Could we please not assault the patient with the crushed spinal cord?" she said as she did, "because this makes me very uncomfortable." Another vicious flare of pain, hot and sharp and evil, ran through Bull's neck and upper back as she strapped him down. One of the tubes was floating free, blood and a bit of flesh adhering to its end.
He didn't know what part of his body it had come out of. Pa was looking at him, and he kept his voice calm.
We've already screwed up twice. We came through the ring, and we let soldiers go on the station. We won't get a third. We can get everyone together, and we can get them out of here.
That's dangerous talk, mister, Ashford spat.
I can't be captain, Bull said. Even if I wasn't stuck in this bed, I'm an Earther. There has to be a Belter in charge.
Fred was right about that. Ashford pulled his arms free of Pa and Macondo, plucked his sleeves back into trim, and steadied himself against the wall.
Doctor, place Mr. Baca in a medical coma. That is a direct order.
Serge, Bull said, I need you to take Captain Ashford into custody, and I need you to do it now.
No one moved. Serge scratched his neck, the sounds of fingernails against stubble louder than anything in the room. Pa's gaze locked in the middle distance, her face sour and angry. Ashford's eyes narrowed, cutting over toward her. When she spoke, her voice was dead and joyless.
Serge, you heard what the chief said.
Ashford gathered himself to launch for Pa, but Serge already had a restraining hand on the captain's shoulder.
This is mutiny, Ashford said. There'll be a reckoning for this.
You'll need to come with us now, Serge said.
Macondo took Ashford's other arm and put it in an escort hold, and the three of them left together. Pa stayed against the wall, held steady by a strap, while the doctor, tutting and muttering under her breath, replaced the catheters and checked the monitors and tubes attached to his skin. For the most part, he didn't feel it. When she was done, the doctor left the room. The door slid closed behind her. For almost a minute, neither of them spoke.
Guess your opinion on mutiny changed, Bull said.
Apparently, Pa said and sighed.
He's not thinking straight, and he's drinking too much.
He made the decision that brought us all here. He can sign his name to all the corpses on all those ships.
I don't think he sees it that way, Pa said, and then, but I think he's putting a lot of effort into not seeing it that way. And he's slipping. I don't think he's well.
It'd be easier if he had an accident, Bull said.
Pa managed to smile. I haven't changed that much, Mr. Baca.
Didn't figure, but I had to say it, he said.
Let's focus on getting everyone safe, and then getting everyone home, she said. It was a nice career, while it lasted. I'm sorry it's ending this way.
Maybe it is, Bull said. But did you come out here to win medals or to do the right thing?
Pa's smile was thin.
I'd hoped for both, she said.
Nothing wrong with a little optimism, long as it doesn't set policy, he said. I'm going to keep on getting everyone on the behemoth.
No weapons but ours, she said. We keep taking all comers, but not if it means having an armed force on the ship.
Already done, Bull said.
Pa closed her eyes. It was easy to forget how much younger than him she was. This wasn't her first tour, but it could have been her second. Bull tried to imagine what he'd have felt like, still half a kid, throwing his commanding officer into the brig. Scared as hell, probably.
You did the right thing, he said.
You'd have to say that. I backed your play. Bull nodded.
I did the right thing. Thank you for supporting me, Captain. Please know that I'll be returning that favor as long as you sit in the big chair.
We aren't friends, she said.
Don't have to be, so long as we get the job done.
Chapter 30. Holden. The Marines weren't gentle, but they were professional.
Holden had seen Martian-powered armor used by a recon marine before. As they moved back through the caverns and tunnels of the station, Holden in thick foam restraints slung across one soldier's back like a piece of equipment, he was aware of how much danger he was in. The men and women in the suits had just watched one of their own be killed and eaten by an alien. They were deep within territory as threatening and unfamiliar as anything he could imagine, and the odds were better than even that they were all blaming him for it. That he wasn't dead already spoke to discipline, training, and a professionalism he would have respected even if his life hadn't depended on it. Whatever frequencies they were speaking on, he didn't have access to. So the furtive journey from the display chamber, or whatever it had been, back to the surface, all happened in eerie silence, as far as he was concerned. He kept hoping to catch a glimpse of Miller. Instead, they passed by the insectal machines, now as still as statues, and over the complex turf. He thought he could see something like a pattern in the waves and ripples that passed along the walls and floor. Complicated and beautiful as raindrops falling on the surface of a lake or music. It didn't comfort him. He tried to get through to the Rocinante, to Naomi, but the Marine he was strapped to had either disabled his suit radio when they were restraining him or something had jammed the signal. One way or another, he couldn't get anything. Not from the Rossi, not from the Marines, not from anywhere. There was only the gentle loping and an almost unbearable dread. His suit gave him a low air warning. He didn't have any sense of where they were or how far they'd gone. The surface of the station might be through the next tunnel, or they might not have reached the halfway point. Or, for that matter, the station could be changing around them, and the way they'd come in might not exist. The suit said he had another 20 minutes. "Hey," he shouted. He tried to swing his legs against the armor of the person carrying him. "Hey, I'm going to need air." The Marine didn't respond. No matter how hard Holden tried to thrash, his strength and leverage were a rounding error compared to the abilities of the powered armor. All he could do was hope that he wasn't about to die from an oversight. Worrying about that was actually better than wondering about Naomi and Alex and Amos. The air gauge was down to 3 minutes, and Holden had shouted himself hoarse when the Marine carrying him crouched slightly, hopped up, and the station fell away beneath them. The luminescent surface irised closed behind them, automatic and unthinking. The skiff hung in the vacuum not more than 500 meters away, its exterior lights making it the brightest thing in the eerie, starless sky. They found their way into the mass airlock quickly. Holden's suit was blaring its emergency. The carbon dioxide levels crept up toward the critical level, and he had to fight to catch his breath. The Marine flipped him into a wall-mounted holding bar and strapped him in. "I'm out of air!" Holden screamed. "Please!" The Marine reached out and cracked the seal on Holden's suit. The rush of air smelled like old plastic and poorly recycled urine. Holden sucked it in like it was roses. The Marine popped off his own helmet. His real head looked perversely small in the bulk of the combat armor. "Sergeant Verbinski," a woman's voice snapped. "Yes, sir," the Marine who'd been carrying him said. "There's something wrong with the prisoner?" "He ran out of air a few minutes back," the woman grunted. Nothing more was said about it. The acceleration burn, when it came, was almost subliminal. A tiny sensation of weight settling Holden into his suit, gone as soon as it came. The Marines murmured among themselves and ignored him. It was all the confirmation he needed. What Miller had said was true. The slow zone's top speed had changed again. And from the expressions on their faces, he guessed that the casualties had been terrible. "I need to check in with my ship," he said. "Can someone contact the Rocinante, please?" No one answered him. He pressed his luck. "My crew may be hurt. If we could just..." "Someone shut the prisoner up," the woman who'd spoken before said. He still couldn't see her. The nearest Marine, a thick-jawed man with skin so black it seemed blue, turned toward him. Holden braced himself for a threat or violence. "There's nothing you could do," the man said. "Please be quiet now." His cell in the brig of the Hammurabi was a little over a meter and a half wide and 3 meters deep. The crash couch was a dirty blue, and the walls and floor a uniform white that gleamed in the harsh light of the overhead LED. The jumpsuit he'd been issued felt like thick paper and crackled when he moved. When the guards came for him, they didn't bother putting the restraints back on his arms and legs. The captain floated near a desk, her close-cropped silver hair making her look like an ancient Roman emperor. Holden was strapped into a crash couch that was canted slightly forward so that he had to look up at her, even without the convenience of an up. "I am Captain Jacunda," she said. "You are a military prisoner. Do you understand what that means?" "I was in the Navy," Holden said. "I understand." "Good. That'll cut about half an hour of legal bullshit." "I'll happily tell you everything I know," Holden said. "No need for the rough stuff." The captain smiled like winter. "If you were anyone else, I'd think that was a figure of speech," she said. "What is your relationship to the structure at the center of the slow zone? What were you doing there?" He had spent so many months trying not to talk about Miller, trying not to tell anyone anything, except Naomi. And even then, he'd felt guilty putting the burden of the mystery on her. On one hand, the chance to unburden himself pulled at him like gravity. On the other, he took a deep breath. "This is going to sound a little strange," he said. "All right." Shortly after the protomolecule construct lifted off from Venus and headed out to start assembling the ring, I was contacted by Detective Josephus Miller, the one who rode Eros down onto Venus, or at least something that looked and talked like him. He's shown up every few weeks since then, and I came to the conclusion that the protomolecule was using him. Well, him and Julie Mao, who was the first one to be infected, to drive me out through the ring. I thought that it wanted me to come here. The captain's expression didn't change. Holden felt a strange lump in his throat. He didn't want to be having this conversation here. He wanted to be talking with Naomi in their bedroom on the Rocinante, or at a bar on Ceres. It didn't matter where, only who. Was she dead? Had the station killed her? "Go on," the captain said. "Apparently, I was mistaken," Holden said. He began with the journey out, with the protomolecule's vision of Miller waiting for him at the station, the attack by her marine, and the consequences as Miller explained them. The visions of the vast empire and the darkness that flowed over it, the death of suns. He relaxed as he went along, the words coming easier, faster. He sounded insane even to himself. Visions no one else could see. Vast secrets revealed only to him. Except it had all been a mistake. He'd thought it was important, that he was special and chosen, and that what had happened to him and his crew had been dictated by a vast and mysterious power. He misunderstood everything. "Doors and corners," Miller had said. And because he hadn't puzzled out what the dead man meant by it, they'd all come through the ring and to the station. His relief and his growing self-disgust mingled with every phrase. He'd been a fool,
dancing at the edge of a cliff, because he'd been sure that he couldn't fall. Not him.
And then I was here, talking to you, he said dryly. I don't know what happens next.
All right, she said. Her expression gave away nothing.
You'll want a full medical workup to see if there's anything organically wrong with my brain, Holden said.
Probably, the captain said. My medical staff has its hands full at the moment. You will be kept in administrative detention for the time being.
I understand, Holden said. But I need to get in contact with my crew. You can monitor the connection. I don't care. I just need to know they're okay.
The angle of the captain's mouth asked why he thought they were.
I'll try to get a report to you, she said. Everyone's scrambling right now, and the situation could get worse quickly.
Is it bad then?
It is. Time in his cell passed slowly. A guard brought tubes of rations, protein, oil, water, and vegetable paste. Sometimes it had a nearly homeopathic dose of curry. It was food meant to keep you alive. Everything after that was your own problem. Holden ate it because he had to stay alive. He had to find his crew, his ship. He had to get out of there. He had seen a massive alien empire fall. He'd seen suns blown apart. He'd watched a man overwhelmed and slaughtered by nightmare mechanisms on a space station that human hands hadn't built. All he could think about was Naomi and Amos and Alex. How they were going to keep their ship. How they were going to get home. And home meant any place but here. Not for the first time, he wished they were all transporting sketchy boxes of unknown cargo to Titania. He floated in the coffin-sized cell and tried not to go crazy from the toxic combination of inaction and mind-bending fear. Even if the whole crew was well, he was in custody of Mars now. He hadn't harmed the Sung-Un, and everyone would know that. He hadn't made the false broadcast. All the things they were accusing him of could fall away, and there would still be the fact that Mars would take away his ship. He tried to focus on that despair, because as bad as it would be, if he kept the ship and lost his crew, that would feel worse.
You've got lousy taste in friends, Miller said.
Where the hell have you been? Holden snapped.
The dead man shrugged. In the cramped quarters, Holden could smell the man's breath. A firefly flicker of blue sped around Miller's head like a low-slung halo and vanished.
Time's hard, he said,
as if the comment carried its own context.
Anyway, we were talking about something.
The station. The lockdown.
Right. Miller said, nodding.
He plucked off his ridiculous hat and scratched his temple.
That. So, the thing is, as long as there's a shitload of energy floating around, the station's not going to get comfortable. You guys have, what, 20 big ships?
About that, I guess.
They've all got fusion reactions. They've all got massive internal power grids. Not a big deal by themselves, but the station's been spooked a couple times. It's jumpy. You're going to have to give it a little massage. Show that you're not a threat. Do that, and I'm pretty sure I can get you moving again. That, or it'll break you all down to your component atoms.
It'll what?
Miller's smile was apologetic.
Sorry, he said.
Joke. Just get the reactors offline and the internal grids off. It'll get you below threshold, and I can take it from there. I mean, if that's what you decide you want to do.
What do you mean, if?
Holden shifted. The ceiling brushed against his shoulders. He couldn't stretch in here. There wasn't room for two people.
There wasn't room
for two people. For a fraction of a second, his brain tried to fit two images, Miller floating beside him and the two small cell together, and failed. The flesh on his back felt like there were insects crawling all over it. The two things couldn't both be true, and his brain shuddered and recoiled from the fact that they were. Miller coughed.
"Don't do that," he said. "This is hard enough the way it is." "What I mean by if is that lockdown's lockdown. I don't get to pick what part of the trap gets unsprung. If I take off the dampening and you all start burning for home or shooting at each other or whatever, that means I also open the gates. All of them.
Including the ones with the burned up stars?"
"No," Miller said. "Those gates are gone. Only real star systems on the other side are the ones that are left."
"Is that a problem?"
"Depends on what comes through," Miller said. "That's a lot of doors to kick down all at once."
The only sound was the hiss of the air recyclers. Miller nodded, as if Holden had said something.
"The other option is figure out a way to sneak back home with your tails between your legs and try and pretend this all never happened."
"You think we should do that?"
"I think there was an empire once that touched thousands of stars. The Eros bug? That's one of their tools. It's a wrench. And something was big enough to put a bullet in them. Whatever it is, could be waiting behind one of those gates, waiting for someone to do something stupid. So, maybe you'd rather set up shop here, make little doomed babies, live and die in the darkness. But at least whatever's out there stays out there."
Holden put his hand on the crash couch to steady himself. His heart was beating a mile a minute, and his hands were clammy and pale. He felt like he might throw up, and wondered whether he could get the vacuum commode working in time. In his memory, stars died.
"You think that's what we should do?" he asked.
"Be quiet and get the hell out of here?"
"No, I want to open them. I've learned everything I can get from here, especially in lockdown. I want to figure out what happened, and that means going and taking a look at the scene."
"You're the machine that finds things?"
"Yes," Miller said. "Consider the source, right? You might want to talk about it with someone who's not dead. You people have more to lose than I do."
Holden thought for a moment, then smiled, then laughed.
"I'm not sure it matters. I'm not in much of a position to set policy," he said.
"That's true," Miller said. "Nothing personal, but you've got lousy taste in friends." Chapter 31. Melba. She was in her prison cell when they spun up the drum. In its previous life, the cell had been some sort of veterinary ward for large animals. Horses, maybe. Or cows. A dozen stalls, six to a side, with brushed steel walls and bars. Real bars. Just like all the old videos, except with a little swinging door at the top where they could shovel in hay. Everything else was antiseptic white. Everything was locked. Her clothes were gone, replaced by a simple pale pink jumpsuit. Her hand terminal was gone. She didn't miss it. She floated in the center of the space, the walls just out of reach of her fingers and toes. It had taken a dozen attempts, reaching the wall and pushing back more and more gently, to find just the right thrust for the air resistance to stop her out where nothing could touch or be touched, where she could float and be trapped by floating. The man in the other cell bounced off his walls. He laughed and he shouted, but mostly he sulked. She ignored him. He was easy to ignore. The air surrounding her had a slight breeze,
the way everything did in a ship. She'd heard a story once on the way out about a ship whose circulation failed in the middle of a night shift. The whole crew had died from the zone of exhausted gas that bubbled around them, drowning in their own recycled air. She didn't think the story was true, because they would have woken up. They would have gasped and thrashed around and gotten up out of their couches, and so they would have lived. People who wanted to live did that. People who wanted to die, on the other hand, just floated. The klaxon sounded through the whole ship, the blatting tone resonating through the decks, taking on a voice like a vast trumpet. First, a warning, then another, then another. Then, silently, the bars retreated from her, falling away, and the back wall touched her shoulder like it wanted her attention but hesitated to ask. Inch by inch, her skin came to rest against the wall. For almost half a minute, the wall touched her, its energy and her inertia pressing them together like praying hands. The drum's acceleration was invisible to her. She only felt the spin sweeping her forward, and then, because forward, down. Her body slid, inch by inch, moving down the wall toward the deck. Her body began to take on weight, the joints in her knees and spine shifting, bearing load. She remembered reading somewhere that a woman coming back from a long time at Null G could have grown almost 2 inches, just from the discs in her spine never having the fluid pushed out of them. Between that and the muscle atrophy, coming back to weight, spin, thrust, or gravity, was the occasion for the most injury. Spinal discs were supposed to be pushed on, supposed to have the fluids go into them and back out. Without that, they turned into water balloons, and sometimes they popped. Her knee brushed the floor, then pressed into it. It had to have been an hour or more since the klaxons. Up and down existed again, and she let down take her. She folded against herself, empty as damp paper. There was a drain in the floor, white ceramic, unstained by any animal's blood or piss. The lights overhead flickered and grew steady again. The other prisoner was shouting for something. Food, maybe. Water. A guard to escort him to the head. It was natural to think of it as the head now, not the restroom, not the water closet. She didn't call for anyone to help her. She just felt her body grow heavier, being pulled down, and because down, out. It wasn't real gravity, so it wasn't real weight. It was her mass trying to fly off into the dark and being restrained. Someone came for the other prisoner. She watched the thick plastic boots flicker across her line of sight. Then voices. Words like loyal and mutiny. Phrases like when the time's right and restore order. They washed over her, and she let them go. Her head hurt a little where her temple pushed against the floor. She wanted to sleep, but she was afraid to dream. More footsteps. The same boots going the other way, passing her. More voices. The boots coming back. The deep metallic clank of the shackle being taken off the stall's door. Her body didn't move, but her attention focused. The guard was different. A woman with broad shoulders and a gun in her hand. She looked at Melba, shrugged, and put a hand terminal into her field of vision. The man on the screen didn't look like a cop. His skin was pale brown like cookie dough. There was something strange about the shape of his face, broad chin, dark eyes, wrinkles in his forehead and the corners of his mouth, that she couldn't place until he spoke and she saw him in motion. Then it was clear he was lying down and looking up at the camera.
"My name's Carlos Baca," the lying down man said. "I'm in charge of security on the Behemoth.
So, this prison you're in? It's mine.
All right, Melba thought.
You, now. I'm thinking you got a